All right. Hello, everyone. This is Stephen Cohen and episode 6 of the podcast, Quantitative Investigations, here from the beautiful metropolis of Colorado Springs. And we are joined with us by the usual Goose the Engineer.
Yes, sir.
I don't know why this guy makes me laugh all the time. I just don't know. I think it's because he's just way too funny looking. What you got for dinner today over there?
Oh, you know, Panda Express. We got that plate. We got fried rice, beef with broccoli, and orange chicken.
Oh, man. You must have just gotten paid because it's different from the usual Doritos and orange juice that you...
I'm out of money now. I'm back to being broke. Until next month.
So a $10 meal at Panda Express just puts you in the poorhouse, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I have to make payments on it.
Well, I'm glad to see that you're eating. I'm also glad to see that you're well. Goose got into a pretty serious car accident earlier, or I should say, I guess it was last week. And car was wrecked, but I'm glad to see that you're in one piece.
Yeah, they can't take me down.
Yeah, it's a good thing because, you know, who else would do my podcast?
Right? That's the first thing I thought about. I said, oh, no. Oh, boy. Who is going to record quantitative investigations?
Glad you know the name of it. All righty. Well, let's get started. At least I can figure out what I'm talking about today. Today's topic is actually a listener request, you know, from the 57 people that have listened to this podcast. Somebody made a request. I think her code name was Amy 666.
That's no bueno. This episode is canceled.
Amy 666. The topic, Amy was inquiring about, is Newt Gingrich. Did he start the incivility in Congress? Is he responsible? Pretty interesting topic. However, in keeping with the typical format of this podcast, we're going to just take a step back and do some updates. The one thing I really want to point out is, and this is absolutely positively true, I experienced this myself. The more you investigate issues, the more you investigate facts and look at source documents, it becomes easier to filter out the garbage. Because a lot of the garbage you hear from people, politicians, unfortunately religious leaders, social media, news media, a lot of it is all the same. A lot of it revolves around the same issues. So it becomes easier to filter out the garbage, and occasionally you actually get validation for the conclusions that you draw. For example, the podcast on election, on the 2020 election, that was episode 5. I did mention that there was a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case that actually allowed undated ballots or ballots in which you could not read the date to be counted. And I was questioning whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated that prior to the 2020 election. It turns out they did not. However, earlier this week, the Supreme Court, in the case is called David Ritter versus Linda Migliore et al., the Supreme Court actually invalidated the counting of undated and or undated ballots or ballots that could not be read. And, of course, these are probably mail-in ballots or ballots dropped off at a drop box. The U.S. Supreme Court shot it down. What does that mean? What that means is, for example, in contrast to the state of Georgia where a whistleblower admitted to harvesting ballots, which is apparently against Georgia election law. That person was an individual. This situation in Pennsylvania was state-sponsored election fraud. Absolutely. I mentioned last time that the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court legislated from the bench. There was no provision in Pennsylvania state law that allowed for the counting of undated ballots or ballots where the dates could not be read. So Pennsylvania allowed it. Of course, like I said, the Supreme Court shot it down. But that is state-sponsored election fraud. Now, was that enough to overturn? Was that enough to steal the election? Again, I don't really know. I don't really know because, as stated in episode 5, Donald Trump had lost a lot of support. So even if the election fraud had not happened, or I should say, even if the Pennsylvania Supreme Court didn't make that decision, to say there was no court case, I'm not sure President Trump would have won. I don't know. So, these are the things that you need to look at when you look at elections. When people are making claims of election fraud, you have to look deep into election law and court decisions. And what has happened in multiple states is that election law was changed by the courts. Now, the Supreme Court is going to be deciding that this session. That's going to be really interesting. Another thing that just happened yesterday was that Hillary Clinton has a video, and the video was published by a company called The Indivisible Group. NewYorkPost.com has this video where she claims that the GOP is planning already to steal the 2024 election. Right, this is what she's saying. Now, how do you know she's lying? Because she is lying. How do you know? Here's how you know. Democrats have been challenging elections, even in the Senate, in the 21st century. In 21st century, they did it 3 times so far, 2001, 2005, and 2016. Even in trying to stop Senate certifications in at least 2016, I've seen those videos. Okay? Now, of course, in 2020, when Republicans say the election was stolen, somehow they're election deniers and Democrats pretend that they've never tried to uncertify or prevent the certification of an election. Then you move to what Hillary Clinton actually did in 2016. And we're going to cover this in another episode that covers Russia collusion. But the Hillary Clinton campaign paid for the Steele dossier. How do we know? Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS has sworn transcribed testimony where he says that. The FBI went on to use that that dossier to take out FISA warrants against Trump staff. And as a matter of fact, what just came out in the Igor Danchenko trial, which just ended last week, the FBI actually offered to pay Christopher Steele, who produced the Steele dossier using information from Igor Danchenko, $1 million if he can verify any of the claims in the dossier. He never made any money because the claims in the dossier could not be confirmed. They couldn't be confirmed. So Hillary is already engaged in election fraud and subversion. Furthermore, according to Newsmax, read an article today, the FBI is currently trying to push its agents and the agency to exaggerate white supremacy and domestic terrorism classifications of cases. If there's being crimes committed, the FBI is trying to push or coerce agents into classifying those as white supremacy, domestic terrorism. This is according to a whistleblower. I don't know the whistleblower's name off the top of my head. I did see an interview with him. So the FBI is attempting to fake white supremacy, domestic terrorism statistics, and Hillary now is attempting to use that to 2 years ahead of time invalidate the 2024 election because they are afraid, obviously, that a Republican is going to win. They're really afraid that Donald Trump is going to win. There's a reason why she's doing this, and this is called the seven pillars of a color revolution. I'll explain that towards the end of the podcast. The last update, this one I find astonishing. Episode 2, we talk about energy policy and how wind and solar are the worst forms of utility generation. And this is according to Energy Information Administration data. Article, just saw it today. Germany is dismantling a wind farm to make way for a coal mine. I got this from oilprice.com, but I know the Fox News website has this under. I saw it before the podcast. This article is going to be all over the web. It's insane what is happening in Germany. But obviously, wind power is working so well that they feel the need to dismantle a wind farm for a coal mine. Now, you have to understand something about German coal. The coal in Germany is called lignite. It is the worst coal you can possibly use for electrical generation. It has a poor heat rating, pretty low BTUs for coal, and it's dirty. It pollutes more so than just about any other coal. I think just pollutes more than any other coal. It is the worst coal, yet they're going to be digging this up to produce electricity because the Russians cut off their gas supplies. The Germans turned off 17 nuclear power plants starting after Fukushima, and their renewable energy is not meeting their power needs. People are going to die this winter in Germany. That is my guess. People are absolutely going to die in Germany because it's going to be cold. And, oh no, that's the conjecture alert. I got nailed. Okay, that's conjecture. But these stories validate what I've said previously on this podcast. And this coal wind farm story is an example of what happens when actual science is ignored. Okay. Let's get on to Speaker Newt Gingrich. The way I'm going to handle this question is I'm going to use the analog of a campfire. Hey, Goose, have you ever built a campfire? Do you know how to build a campfire?
There's first you need a way to make fire. You need kindling and leaves, some bigger logs to...
Okay.
You know?
All right.
Kind of build it up.
All right, so basically you know how to make a campfire, but quite frankly, I think you really need to just get outside. You need to go into the woods. You need to go camping and, build a fire.
I see natural light for about 2 to 5 minutes a day.
Well, if you weren't a vampire, you know, you could actually get out in the woods.
Yeah, but then I'd get tan, and that would be a crime.
You know, out of the 2 or 3 people that actually listen to this podcast who know who Goose really is, they're probably going to be laughing in their pants right now.
Laughing in and out of their pants, yes.
Okay, so the one thing everyone needs to keep in mind, rarely, and I'll say almost never, does anything happen in isolation. Things just do not happen by themselves. And I'm going to make the case with this particular issue, and we're going to use the campfire analog. As Goose did correctly say, to build a fire, you need kindling. You need wood. You need the lighter, right? And then once the fire is lit, Sometimes you put on an accelerator to really just blast the fire, like gasoline or something else flammable, to really gas that fire. So getting to the basics, and talking about Newt Gingrich himself, there's an article in The Atlantic. It was written in November 2018, and it's titled "The Man Who Broke Politics." And this is an interview with Newt Gingrich, and it describes the strategy that Newt Gingrich used to win in 1994, I believe it was. I'll get to that. Whenever Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House, I think it was 1994. But anyway, the story starts early. June 4th, 1978, Gingrich gathered a bunch of college Republicans at a Holiday Inn near the Atlanta airport and gave a speech. And what he wanted to do, according to the article, and I think this is his words, he'd come to foment a revolution. And here's a quote from the article. "One of the great problems we have in the Republican Party is that we don't encourage you to be nasty," he told the group. "We encourage you to be neat, obedient, and loyal, and faithful, and all those Boy Scout words, which would be great around the campfire, but are lousy in politics." By the way, the campfire reference is really a coincidence. I didn't even think about that when I just gave my previous campfire analog. "For their party to succeed," Gingrich went on, "the next generation of Republicans would have to learn to, quote-unquote, raise hell, to stop being so nice, to realize that politics was, above all, a cutthroat war for power, and to start acting like it." That's what he said. That was 1978. That was during the Carter administration. And after the Nixon resignation and after Carter defeated Gerald Ford in 1976. Gingrich had a plan. And the way he saw it, the Republicans would never be able to take back the House as long as they kept compromising with Democrats out of some high-minded civic desire. And basically the purpose of this high-minded civic desire was to keep congressional business humming along. Apparently the Republicans did not want to necessarily rock the boat. His strategy, according to the article, was to blow up the bipartisan coalitions that were essential to legislating and then seize on the resulting dysfunction to wage a populist crusade against the institution of Congress itself. That was his strategy. So reading that, 1978 is a lot earlier than when he took control of Congress. He had a long-haul strategy. Now, at the time, as time went on through the 80s, according to the article, there were tectonic shifts in American politics around issues of race and civil rights. And this started to trigger what the article says is an ideological sorting between the two parties. So, as I said, nothing happens in isolation. What I see when I look at this is that there are political conditions that are changing, that are actually starting to fall into Newt Gingrich's plan. And the question that needs to be asked is, if this ideological sorting between the two parties was not happening, would Newt Gingrich have been successful? Would he, quote unquote, have been able to destroy the civility of Congress? Would he have been able to do that? So I consider this tectonic shift as laying the kindling of the fire. The article goes on to say that liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats had been vanishing and were beginning to vanish And as the ideological divide took hold, these cross-party partnerships vanished. Did Newt Gingrich have anything to do with that? It started, no. It started in the 80s, and I became politically active, well, not politically active, but politically aware in the early 80s. The President Ronald Reagan in 1984, that was the first election in which I was able to vote for president. So this had started happening before Newt Gingrich took hold. Let's keep going with this article. Gingrich, according to the article, he was hustling for this cause. He was trying to get into the Washington Post. He was trying to get notoriety. And he did that by starting fights. Whatever he had to get attention. In his idea, in his words, the number one fact about the news media is they love fights. When you give them confrontations, you get attention. When you get attention, you can educate. I don't know if that's really the case. I don't agree with that statement, but that's the way, according to this article, Newt Gingrich viewed it. But despite his grassroots following that was growing, he did remain unpopular with a contingent of congressional Republicans who had been scandalized by his tactics. Apparently, what Newt Gingrich was doing was trying to root out complacent Republicans. However, the Democrats elected a Texas congressman named Jim Wright to be Speaker of the House, 1987 to 1989. And most people who are familiar with the way Congress operated in the 80s under Reagan, Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House, Ronald Reagan was the president. The two may have had their scuffles, but in the end, once the cameras were off and once they were, you know, drinking in whatever social club they were drinking in, you know, they would be congenial. They'd talk, they'd be friendly. However, this Jim Wright made considerable efforts to sideline the Republican majority and really, really angered the GOP moderates. See, ladies and gentlemen, you probably hear frequently that it's the independents that guide, that decide election. It's not always. I mean, you have your fringes of both parties, and then you have the silent majority of both parties along with independents. Those are the people that are going to usually decide elections. And when you anger the silent majority and the independents, that's not going to bode well. That's not going to bode well. So Jim Wright, I would consider, was adding wood to the kindling. So here's the question. Did Newt Gingrich destroy congeniality of Congress? Did he do it? Is he the cause? Again, as I said, nothing happens in isolation. For example, did Hitler start World War II? Or did it actually start at the Treaty of Versailles? Or did it actually start with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914? Everything is a matter of perspective. And it's too easy to identify a boogeyman as a trigger point. It's too easy to say, this caused something. That is the lazy man's way out. Or a lazy woman. Now I'm going to be accused of it. Was that a sexist remark there, Goose?
That's why I use the gender-neutral term, homie. The lazy homie's way out.
Okay. That was the lazy homie's way out. It's laziness. To just say, oh, that guy did it. I'm sorry. Nothing happens in isolation. And I've probably given away where I'm going with this. So where am I going with this? I don't really know. That's the beauty. Sometimes I never know where I'm going. So I have a formula for the effects of events. It is E sub 0 equals E sub 1 times T squared. E sub 0 is the initial event. E sub 1 is the final event. T squared is time squared. So in order to find what the effect of an event was after the initial event, you divide E sub 0 by T squared. What that tells you as is the time of the event, the time of the initial event really weakens as the square of time. And by the way, I just pulled that one out of thin air in case anyone was wondering, but it's true. The farther in time you get away from an initial event, the less effect it has. Okay? And what I want to do is start going through some events that occurred after Newt Gingrich was gone in office. He left Congress in January of 1999. Okay? Well, starting with the later and working back towards 1999, this is just some few events. The Brett Kavanaugh hearing. Christine Blasey Ford falsely accused Kavanaugh of raping her. How do we know she falsely accused Kavanaugh? She named four witnesses, one of whom was her best friend at the time. None of them corroborated the story. Her best friend didn't even remember Brett Kavanaugh being at this party. She lied. And the Democrats were well aware that it was a false story, but they presented it towards the end of the Kavanaugh hearing. 2017. Adam Schiff begins to falsely accuse Trump of Russia collusion. He was lying. He knew he was lying because he interviewed, under oath, 53 people, none of whom stated under oath that there was any evidence of collusion with Russia. He knew it, but he actually kept telling the news that he had the evidence. 2013, Alan Grayson, a congressman from Florida, Democrat, equated Republicans to the Ku Klux Klan. 2012, Harry Reid lies about Mitt Romney's taxes during a presidential election, and he was pretty happy about it. He was pretty happy about it. Do any of these relate to Newt Gingrich? June 22nd, 2005, Dick Durbin, Democratic senator, referred to the treatment of Gitmo prisoners by Nazis, Soviets, and Cambodians. He's obviously talking about Republicans and also the military who were guarding these Gitmo prisoners from Afghanistan. On the same day, June 22nd, 2005, Durbin supposedly apologized. Bill Frist, he was a Senate Majority Leader, said, "Shameful does not begin to describe this heinous slander against our country." Same day, John Hostetler, a Republican from Indiana, stated, "Like moths to a flame, Democrats can't help themselves when it comes to denigrating and demonizing Christians." It was all around the same issue. Does any of this have to do with Newt Gingrich? Well, I'll tell you what. Let's see what happened before Newt Gingrich got into office, before he became Speaker of the House, 1991. Clarence Thomas. The Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing was one of the most egregious. I have to say the Brett Kavanaugh one was worse, but the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing was abysmal, where they accuse him of being sexually inappropriate with Anita Hill. Everyone should listen to video or watch video of Clarence Thomas's response. It's beautiful. What he called it was a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks to dare to speak their minds. So this is 1991, before Newt Gingrich got into office. Now, of course, I bring up some of these or aren't necessarily Republican on Democrat in Congress acrimony, but you better believe. You better believe if you're a Republican and the Democrats slander one of your Supreme Court picks, you are not going to think very highly of them when you actually get into the chamber. You better believe it. February 1991, Congress attempts to impeach George H.W. Bush by using charges of violating the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution by putting U.S. soldiers in the Middle East who are overwhelmingly poor, white, black, Mexican-American, as well as basing their military service on the coercion of a system that denies viable economic opportunities to these classes of citizens. At some point, we'll actually, I think during the Trump-Russia collusion episode, which will be forthcoming, we'll discuss impeachment. June 4th, 1985, Biden uses the N-word during a confirmation hearing. And this was the confirmation hearing of William Reynolds, which was Reagan's assistant attorney general for civil rights. He was being confirmed for that position. Let's keep going. Now, the one issue that I forgot to actually mention here and get notes on was the Robert Bork confirmation hearing, where Ted Kennedy actually accused Robert Bork, or claimed that if Bork was confirmed, that women would be treated as if they were in the Stone Age, black people wouldn't be able to vote, and other horrendous lies. This was actually the first real serious slander, maligning confirmation hearing that I recall of a Supreme Court justice. And as a matter of fact, there was a verb developed after that. It's called being borked, which is what happened to Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh. They were borked, and Robert Bork was not confirmed. In October of 1984, Walter Mondale, who was running against, Ronald Reagan, demanded an apology because supposedly a Bush aide referred to Geraldine Ferraro, who was Walter Mondale's VP pick, as bitchy. Okay. As you can see, though, the point of all this is there was acrimony before Newt Gingrich got into Congress, and of course we know after Newt Gingrich left Congress. So the question is, did Newt Gingrich have anything to do with the acrimony before or after? I mean, actually, the question is actually after he got into Congress. So all these incivility events that happened before Newt Gingrich got into Congress was adding more wood to the fire. So you had the kindling, you had the wood. What did Newt Gingrich do? He lit the match. However, if there were a sufficient number of senators and representatives who were against the methods of Newt Gingrich, then the incivility would have abated. It would have abated. Because the wood would have burned out. The wood would have burned out. The fire would have died. And the tactics of Newt Gingrich would have simply faded away. That's not what happened, is it? No. That's not what happened. What happened was congressmen, congresswomen, senators, they put gas on the fire. they saw the tactics of Newt Gingrich be successful, and they just put gas on the fire. But I'm here, and I'm here to opine and determine that Newt Gingrich was actually, he was actually shaped by events. He was shaped by the events prior to his entry into Congress. If Robert Bork wasn't borked, if Clarence Thomas wasn't borked, if Congress hadn't tried to illegitimately impeach Bush, if Joe Biden had decided not to use the N-word in confirmation hearings and been more civil, if these things hadn't happened, if the tone had been more congenial in the 1980s, Newt Gingrich would not have been able to pull off what he did. If the ideological divide hadn't already been set, hadn't already been splitting Republicans and Democrats, Newt Gingrich would not have been able to light that fire. He would have struck the match, but the fire would not have ignited. Nothing, ladies and gentlemen, happens in a vacuum. Nothing. I also don't believe in necessarily in coincidences. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Ah, here you go. Guess what? I just found my notes on Robert Bork. Nice to have my podcast organized, huh, Goose?
Always. I'm all organized over here, you know. No faults on this side of the wall.
So here's the quote. Yeah. Within 40 minutes of Reagan's announcement, Robert Bork being nominated, Senator Ted Kennedy took to the Senate floor with a condemnation of Robert Bork's America as, quote, a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions. Blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters. Rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids. School children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists would be censored at the whim of the government, and the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens. This is what Ted Kennedy said. It's pretty, that's pretty damning. And that's what Ted Kennedy did in Congress. So, there's also a quote from the New York Times in January 1st, 1971. This is actually when Richard Nixon had finished his first Congress. It was Congress, one Congress last 2 years. It says, for all the furor of its dying hours, the Democratic-controlled 91st Congress, the first Congress in more than a century to confront a new president of the opposite party, produced less friction, more legislation than most observers had expected when it first convened nearly 2 years ago. So when the 91st Congress convened in January of 1969, which is Congress convenes before the president is sworn in, there was an expectation that nothing would get done. Yet somehow, work got done. So we know, as late as the first Nixon Congress, we know that there was still congeniality. But we also know, based on the quotes that I had read, that certainly started fading away in the 80s. The 80s seemed to be a really pivotal time in acrimony between Republicans and Democrats. So there you go. There is another event that I've heard in multiple places that really seemed to spark the acrimony between Republicans and Democrats. And it's called C-SPAN. in March, on March 19th, 1979, C-SPAN first broadcast from the U.S. House of Representatives. Once that happened, and once politicians were on camera, they were able to take advantage of being on camera. And in order for a politician to take advantage of being on camera, they had to bash their opponents. This is actually cited in The Atlantic's article regarding Newt Gingrich, because Newt Gingrich somehow used C-SPAN as to try and get his points across. See, the advent of C-SPAN, I've heard from multiple sources, is actually the event that some people credit with the acrimony in Congress. Again, if the ideological divide hadn't been happening, I'm sorry, it wouldn't have taken off. And showboating for the camera, and of course, in order to showboat, you have to put down your opponent. I don't know, but it certainly could have been a contributor. Certainly could have been a contributor. I guess everyone can see where we're going with this, and that is, Newt Gingrich likes to credit himself for the incivility in Congress. Other people like to credit him for the incivility in Congress. I'm sorry, I don't go along with that. I think Newt Gingrich was a product of the times. And if the times had been different, Newt Gingrich would not have been able to do what he did. So I don't buy it, and I'm not going to buy it. There's also a long game here that we can't forget. Going back in time, early, I think it was 1961, Saul Alinsky put out his Rules for Radicals. This is a tactic designed for radicals to promote change. Generally, change through coercion. I implore everyone to read these, and I actually implore everyone to read his Rules for Radicals alongside Joseph Goebbels' Rules for Propaganda during World War II. I think you'll see some similarities. Let's go through his rules. Always remember the first rule of power tactics. Power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. Number two, never go outside the experience of your people. Number three, wherever possible, go outside the experience of the enemy. Here you want to cause confusion, fear, and retreat. Make the enemy live up to their own book of rules. That was number four. And number five, ridicule is man's most potent weapon. Number six, a good tactic is one that your people enjoy. Number seven, a tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. Number eight, keep the pressure on. Number nine, the threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. Number 10, the major premise for tactics is the development of operations that will maintain a constant pressure upon the opposition. Number 11, if you push a negative hard and deep enough, it will break through into its counterside. Number 12, the price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. Number 13, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Everybody should take a look at these rules. And when you look at these rules and you hear what politicians say and what the news media says, you will see that what they do fits into these rules. These rules were developed way before Newt Gingrich came into office, more than 30 years. Hillary Clinton was a student, I should say, a protege of Saul Alinsky. Other Democrats have studied the rules for radicals and use them. They are used, and I'm not going to lie, they are effective to a certain point. This is part of the acrimony we're seeing today. This is part of it. You can't ignore this. And everybody needs to understand and study these rules, because then you'll see political speech and how it fits into these rules. And then you'll start to understand what is garbage and what is fact. You will start to understand it. You'll start to understand what politicians do. The next set of rules. We were talking about Hillary Clinton and the video that she just put out claiming that white supremacists are already stealing the 2024 election. There, and I mentioned the seven pillars of a color revolution. This is a strategy developed in the Obama administration, in the Obama State Department. And who was the Secretary of State for a while? Oh, yeah, that's right, Hillary Clinton. These are rules, and these are situational rules that the U.S. government has used to actually overthrow governments. I think they did this in Ukraine. And I cannot remember the... Uh-oh, it's a late conjecture alert. That's right. I said I think that they used it in Ukraine. I'm actually pretty sure, but I'm not 100% sure. This is before Zelensky was elected. So this was developed in the State Department. And I'm going to go through these rules. And you're going to, and again, this is situational. You can only use this strategy when a certain situation presents itself. Here it is. Number one, a semi-autocratic rather than a fully autocratic regime. So you have a regime that's, say, not the Iranian mullahs, but something less autocratic than that. You have a current president or a current leader that's unpopular. You have a united and organized opposition. And here you go, an ability to quickly drive home the point that voting results were falsified. And enough independent media to inform citizens about the falsified vote. You have a political opposition capable of mobilizing tens of thousands or more demonstrators to protest electoral fraud. And you have divisions among the regime's coercive forces. Hillary Clinton knows what this is. Hillary Clinton, the reason why I know she's lying is because she knows what this is, and she is trying to drive home a message that the 2024 election is going to be fraudulent before it even happens. And the FBI is falsifying crime data and crime reports to make them look like there's more white supremacy than there really is. That's what Hillary Clinton's message is all about. That is also what's going on in the United States. This is trying to be used. And you may not believe me. Hey, that's fine. But you should look at what this, you should understand what the seven pillars of a color revolution are. You can see what people are doing. And again, as I told you, the more you look into facts of an issue, it becomes easier to filter out the garbage. Hillary Clinton knows that white supremacists are not stealing the election right now. She knows it. She also knows that the FBI is trying to falsify data, according to a whistleblower. She knows that if she drives a message of a faulty election that she can go ahead and actually cause such strife that she can actually cause civil unrest. There are forces, and there are serious consequences, I should say, to what all this is doing. All the acrimony in Congress, all the lies being told by various people. There are consequences to this. And one of the consequences is public acrimony, acrimony amongst the citizenry. And it's causing balkanization of American life. For example, liberal companies are discriminating against conservatives, and that includes banks, big tech, simply because of disagreements on political issues. Now, by the way, I first observed this, and it was the other side. It was the conservatives who are actually doing this balkanization. I was in Moscow, Idaho, went to University of Idaho to defend my master's paper for my geological engineering degree. And I was listening to the radio, and this is the first time I'd heard this. Now, if you're a Christian, want to do business with other Christians, you know, call this whatever network. And I said to myself, that's bad. That is not a good way to be. And it's not. But liberals have taken up that mantra. They are balkanizing commerce. Social media, of course, the news media are also fostering discord. There are forces that want a civil war in this country. There are. And the problem is, those people who think they want a civil war are too stupid to understand what it really means. If you want to know what a civil war means, I implore everyone to read a book called The Battle Cry of Freedom by James McPherson. This is a book, it is an eye-opener, and it'll make you shudder to realize that we as a nation are not all that different from pre-Civil War America. And the problem is the consequences of any kind of mass conflagration, if this ever got to a mass conflagration, if everyone picked the sides and started fighting each other, there'd be tens of millions of people dead. Our economy would be set back decades. And I get the feeling that the leftists and communists in this country think that this would be an easy win for them. Don't forget, there are 400 some odd million guns in this country. And who do you think owns most of those guns? And who do you think they're going to fight for? We're not in a good position right now. I'm going to go back to my previous conclusion. Newt Gingrich didn't start this. Newt Gingrich was created. The Newt Gingrich phenomenon was created. There were geopolitical situations in this country that created his ability to do what he did. And once he left Congress, there were people more than willing to pour gas on the fire. I guess now they call it gaslighting. That is what they're doing. That is what's happening. And we as the population need to understand the politicians are not going to start this. The politicians are not going to stop this. It is only when the people decide that they need to actually put sand on the fire instead of gasoline that things will change. And that is where I am. So to recap, in order to appease the critics, where do we go from here? So, what did we talk about today? We spoke about the political conditions that existed after Newt Gingrich and before Newt Gingrich, and that whereas he may want to take credit for incivility in Congress, he can take credit all he wants. People can make him the boogeyman all they want. I'm sorry. Again, I don't buy it. All right. What do you think about that, Goose?
I think that's a wrap, my boy.
Have any questions?
No. Everything was pretty straightforward. I actually paid attention this time.
I was just saying, are you even awake?
I was only asleep for 5 minutes today. So.
Yeah, well, maybe if you weren't such a vampire and got more sun, maybe you'd actually stay awake. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. And I hope you enjoy this podcast. Our next few episodes, we're going to cover the abortion issue. And basically, we're going to be looking at court cases and what they mean. And we're going to look at, I'm going to try and get a guest for my episode on racism. And then we'll hit Russia collusion. So those will probably be the next three episodes. Thank you very much, and I bid you a fond adieu.